Shalom and welcome. Today we're going to discuss the concept of selfishness and the myth of self-esteem. Psalm 131. Adonai, my heart isn't proud. I don't set my sight too high. I don't take part in great affairs or in wonders far beyond me. No, I keep myself calm and quiet, like a little child on its mother's lap. I keep myself like a little child. Israel, put your hope in Adonai from now on and forever. It is a long-standing rebuke to the typical self-centered, arrogant person to realize our collective capacity for illusion and self-deception. As David Myers states in his book, The Inflated Self, in the long run, truth provides a more durable foundation for comfort than does illusion. Seek truth first, and you may eventually find comfort, advise the sages. Seek comfort first, and when the illusion crumbles, you will find despair. As Reinhold Niebuhr concluded, faith is always imperiled on the one side by despair and on the other side by optimism. Of these two enemies of faith, optimism is the more dangerous. What is self-esteem? This is a phrase that is bandied about in all manners of circles. In my own profession, in the counseling profession, it's a big buzzword. But it's also found in education, in public policy, in Christian sermons, and in books. There are many books about this. What is self-esteem? Well, first of all, to esteem something means to have a high opinion of it. To have high self-esteem means holding a high opinion of oneself. Professionals and lay people across all disciplines, from doctors, counselors, mental health therapists, parents, coaches, pastors, and most importantly, teachers, have all been fed the lie that high self-esteem is the magical fairy dust that will transform inner-city gang members into responsible citizens, drug addicts into sober, happy people, and depressed housewives into energetic and bubbly personalities. Take our school system. There's a heavy emphasis on social acceptance between peers. Equality and sameness become normative. Average becomes the goal, with mediocrity the foreseeable outcome. In terms of goal setting, if you aim at nothing, you will likely hit it. We have social promotion, where ensuring a child meets certain educational standards before advancing him or her is less important than the social consequences of holding a child back. The dumbing down of our educational systems have seriously eroded our corporate collective abilities to engage the world at a competitive level. We remove scoring systems in athletic competition where everyone gets a trophy regardless of performance. After all, there are no winners and losers in the modern cult of high self-esteem. How does this prepare a young person for the reality of the world of employment where performance is everything? You don't get a participation trophy for just showing up at work. You actually have to produce something. In the 1970s, we heard the buzz phrase from the book, I'm okay, you're okay. This was a reaction to correct the assumed thought that we suffered from I'm not okay, you're okay. Psychology experiments have revealed that people tend to attribute positive behaviors to themselves, meaning they take credit for their good acts, and negative behaviors they attribute to external factors, meaning they deny responsibility for their bad acts. This is kind of across the board with human nature. Each year, the College Board tests millions of high school seniors on leadership ability, athletic ability, and ability to get along with others. In leadership ability, 70% of high school seniors rated themselves above average, with 2% rating themselves below average. In athletic ability, 60% rated themselves better than average, 6% rated themselves below average. Ability to get along with others, 60% rated themselves in the top 10%, and 25% rated themselves in the top 1%, 0% rated themselves below average. This is stunning. A study popularized by Charles Krauthammer, writing in Time magazine, investigated the self-concepts of 13-year-olds in Britain, Canada, Ireland, Korea, Spain, and the United States. Each was administered a standardized math test. In addition, they were asked to rate the statement, "I am good at mathematics." The Americans judged their abilities the most highly. 68% agreed with the statement. On the actual math test, the Americans came last. Krauthammer concludes, American students may not know their math, but they have evidently absorbed the lessons of the newly fashionable self-esteem curriculum wherein kids are taught to feel good about themselves. Now, if most people are merely the average persons they must be statistically, but think and behave as though they are superior, their goals and expectations must inevitably conflict. This cognitive dissonance between belief and reality is bound to cause troubles for the individual, but even more importantly, for our collective abilities as a culture in a world that is increasingly competitive on a global scale. Whatever happened to the concept of excellence? Let's take a look at some examples from the Bible about the nature of this self. Consider Nabal, or Naval, in 1 Samuel 25:11. He was a rich businessman. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. David came in peace and protected his interests. But then Nabal spurned David's messengers, and God struck him dead. Nabal said, "Am I supposed to take my bread, my water, and my meat that I slaughtered for my shears and give it to men coming from who knows where?" A very self-centered person. In Esther 6:6, consider Haman. He was a self-centered egotist. So Haman came in. The king said to him, "What should be done for a man that the king wants to honor?" Haman thought to himself, he had an inner dialogue going here, "Whom would the king want to honor more than me?" Consider James and John, Yaakov and Yochanan, the sons of Zabdi, in Mark 10:35-37. They came up to him and said, "Rabbi, we would like you to do us a favor." He said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They replied, "When you are in your glory, let us sit with you, one on your right hand and the other on your left." In Mark 10:43-44, Yeshua said, "But among you it must not be like that. On the contrary, whoever among you wants to be a leader must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must become everyone's slave." Consider Solomon, Ecclesiastes 2:10-11. "I denied my eyes nothing they wanted. I withheld no pleasure from myself, for I took pleasure in all my work, and this was my reward for all my work. Then I looked at all that my hands had accomplished and at the work I had toiled at, and I saw that it was all meaningless and feeding on wind, and that there was nothing to be gained under the sun." You see, friends, the possession of wisdom does not guarantee that it will be used. By the end of his life, Solomon had broken most of the proverbs he had written. If wisdom is the application of knowledge, then obedience is the application of wisdom. Solomon's wisdom did not fail him. He failed to follow it. You see, it's not how you start the walk of faith, it's how you finish. Consider the rich fool in Luke 12:16-21. And he gave them this illustration. "There was a man whose land was very productive. He debated with himself, 'What should I do? I haven't enough room for all my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and I'll store all my wheat and other goods there. Then I'll say to myself, you're a lucky man. You have a big supply of goods laid up that will last many years. Start taking it easy. Eat, drink, enjoy yourself. But God said to him, you fool, this very night you will die, and the things you prepared, whose will they be? That's how it is with anyone who stores up wealth for himself without being rich toward God. Hoarding is a common perplexity of the rich. He had the goods, but not the ears. He tried to satisfy the soul with earthly delights. In Luke 16:19-25, it says, once there was a rich man who used to dress in the most expensive clothing and spent his days in magnificent luxury. At his gate had been laid a beggar named Eleazar, who was covered with sores. He would have been glad to eat the scraps that fell from the rich man's table, but instead even the dogs would come and lick his sores. In time, the beggar died and was carried away by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In Sheol, where he was in torment, the rich man looked up and saw Abraham far away with Eleazar at his side. He called out, Father Abraham, take pity on me and send Eleazar just to dip the tip of his finger in water to cool my tongue, because I'm in agony in this fire. However, Abraham said, Son, remember that when you were alive, you got the good things while he got the bad, but now he gets his consolation here, while you are the one in agony. When we consider the whole concept of self and selfishness, self-esteem, I'm drawn to the writings of the missionary to India and devotional writer E. Stanley Jones, wrote many books, Amazing Devotional Thoughts. In one of his books, he talked about a psychological portrait of Judas Iscariot, which, coming from a counseling background, drew me to this article, and I find it fascinating. First of all, in his writings about Judas, E. Stanley Jones said that Judas thought one could give too much to Yeshua. In John 12:5, it said, this perfume is worth a year's wages. Why wasn't it sold and the money given to the poor? He objected to the woman's lavish gift. His objection was a sign of an inward holding back. He was also the center. In Matthew 26:14-15, it said, then one of the 12, the one called Yehuda from Kiriath, went to the head Kohanim and said, what are you willing to give me if I turn Yeshua over to you? They counted out 30 silver coins and gave them to Yehuda. He was the center of his world here. He was saying, what will you give me? Wasn't that the first step down for the prodigal son? Consider selfish prayers. Name it and claim it. Blab it and grab it. The text goes on in Matthew 26:16. From then on, he looked for a good opportunity to betray him. He sought opportunity to betray the master. He tried to arrange his world so that it would not fall to pieces, but it did fall to pieces. Matthew 26:23-25 says, he answered, the one who dips his matzah in the dish with me is the one who will betray me. The Son of Man will die just as the Tanakh says he will, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for him had he never been born. Yehuda, the one who was betraying him, then asked, surely, Rabbi, you don't mean me. He answered, the words are yours. You see, the heart of things began to be revealed. His world did collapse. It says, then Judah saw. In Matthew 27:3-5, when Yehuda, who had betrayed him, saw that Yeshua had been condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the head Kohanim and elders, saying, I sinned in betraying an innocent man to death. What is that to us? They answered. That's your problem. Hurling the pieces of silver into the sanctuary, he left. Then he went off and hanged himself. He saw his world beginning to tumble to pieces. Verse 3 says he repented, but in the wrong direction. He went to religion. He turned in useless regret to the high priest and elders for absolution instead of to Yeshua. Verse 3 says he brought back. He tried to steady his tottering world by a halfway restitution to undo the damage. He brought back the money, but retained himself. Their response? In verse 4, what does that matter to us? His world is now insecure and not trustworthy. His companions let him down. Sin has no sustenance. Sin doesn't care about your consequences or your feelings. Verse 5 says he flung down the money out of guilt. The thing that seemed to matter so much in the beginning, now the precious thing was turned to ashes. Verse 5 says he went off. Well, he went off from opportunity, he went off from Messiah, and he went off from life. Verse 5 says he hanged himself. The self that was so demanding and so central in the beginning, saying, "Give me," became impossible to live with. So he hanged the self that started him down. Complete collapse will be the end of an egocentric self. Now let's consider another alternative that's put forth concerning self-love. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. What does this mean? Many people see this differently. Matthew 22:37-40, Yeshua was once asked, "Rabbi, which of the mitzvot in the Torah is the most important?" He told him, "You are to love Adonai your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. This is the greatest and most important mitzvah. And a second is similar to it. You are to love your neighbor as yourself. All of the Torah and the prophets are dependent on these two mitzvot." Now, it's important to recognize that Yeshua here is saying, love Adonai your God, and there's a second that is similar, love your neighbor as yourself, and then he closes with, all of the Torah and the prophets are dependent on these two mitzvot. There's two, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. The love thyself theory sees three commands. One, love God, two, love your neighbor, and three, love yourself. But you see, the Bible is not teaching self-love. It merely recognizes that man indeed already loves himself. Paul recognized this in Ephesians 5:29, when he said, "Why, no one ever hated his own flesh. On the contrary, he feeds it well and takes care of it, just as the Messiah does the Messianic community." It would not change the meaning to read the text as, "You shall love your neighbor as much as you do, in fact, love yourself." Now, self-love is unacceptable linguistically. First of all, the Greek verb love in these verses is agapao. The definition always includes the element of sacrifice and of service to others. So how do we agape ourselves? How do we sacrifice ourselves to serve ourselves? Agape love cannot be self-directed. If it is, it negates itself. It ceases to be self-sacrifice and becomes self-service. We can compare Matthew 22:39 with 2 Timothy 3:1-5 and Mark 8:34-35 with Luke 9:23. Matthew 22:39, and a second is similar to it. You are to love your neighbor as yourself. In 2 Timothy 3:1-5, it says, "Moreover, understand this, in the Acharit HaYamim, in the end days, will come trying times. People will be self-loving, money-loving, proud, arrogant, insulting, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, uncontrolled, brutal, hateful of good, traitorous, headstrong, swollen with conceit, loving pleasure rather than God, as they retain the outer form of religion, but deny its power. Stay away from these people." It is so significant that Paul, writing to Timothy, includes this concept of self-loving in this laundry list of horrible things. He's not affirming that we should be loving self, is he? Mark 8, 34 and 35. Then Yeshua called the crowd and his Talmudim to him and told them, "If anyone wants to come after me, let him say no to himself, take up his execution stake, and keep following me. For whoever wants to save his own life will destroy it. But whoever destroys his life for my sake and for the sake of the good news will save it." Finally, in Luke 9:23, "Then to everyone he said, if everyone wants to come after me, let him say no to himself, take up his execution stake daily, and keep following me. For whoever tries to save his own life will destroy it, but whoever destroys his life on my account will save it." So what do we do with this self? Well, E. Stanley Jones came up with 6 attitudes towards self. The first one is deny yourself existence. Self does not exist. This is monism. We see evidences of this in Hinduism, Hare Krishna. The word Maya means illusion, so everything's illusion. We see evidence of this denial of self-existence in Christian Science solipsism. Well, nothing really exists. Everything is just a projection or a figment of our mind, or we're all living in illusion. What's interesting is these people still look both ways at crosswalks, because that bus that's coming down at you at 35 miles an hour is real. This denial of self-existence is only a verbal release. Very soon, the facts close in and upset your little dreamland. You are not God, you are you. A suppressed self is unhappy. It's straining at the leash. It's longing for freedom. White-knuckle sobriety destroys peace and poise. So denying your self-existence doesn't work. Number 2, decorate yourself. Okay, I can't deny that self exists, so I'm going to decorate it. I'm going to make myself presentable to self and others. You dress yourself up in altruistic garments of religion, civic involvement, etc. Consider the self-righteous Pharisee. But you see, it's the same old self bidding for attention. There's an inner conflict over motives, and this produces strain and disharmony. Even doing the right things for the wrong reasons, you know, tithing money, talents, and abilities, teaching Bible classes, seeking educational accomplishments, many things can be right, but if it's done for the wrong reasons to decorate self, it's feeding self. So if we don't want to decorate self, number 3 is deify yourself. Now we get into some of the New Age nonsense. I think of the author Shirley MacLaine. She wrote a book, Out on a Limb, and somebody wrote a rebuttal called Out on a Broken Limb. This is where we make yourself central and absolute. Or perhaps we have an obsessive concern for our legacy. An uninhibited self can drive to much success and power, but at what cost? What is a profit if a man gains the whole world and loses his soul? A proud, self-assertive person is not generally punished outwardly, but inwardly. The payoff is the self, the person in the mirror you have to live with. When you make yourself God, then the devotee eventually despises the God he has set up. Basically, we make lousy gods. We can't deliver the goods. Number 4, we can try to deceive ourselves. We press the self down into the subconscious mind, put the lid on, and say it isn't there. Now, it's said that neurotics build castles in the sky, and psychotics live there, and psychiatrists going around picking up the rent. There is such a thing as honest deception. Our conscious motives may be clear and good, but by their fruits you shall know them. Is there a presence of inner strain and stress? Is there a conflict, a suppressed self wanting expression, getting it only through self-deception? Number 5, we can consider dividing ourselves. This is the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde approach, or sometimes known as the sinning saint. we serve two masters to try to get the most out of both. Mark Twain was once asked if he believed in polygamy. He said absolutely not, because he said the Bible says no man can serve two masters. Dividing ourselves into spiritual and worldly, we try to get the consolations of spiritual life and the kicks of our worldly life, but unfortunately they cancel each other out, because kicks produce kickbacks. A house divided cannot stand. This pertains to individuals as well as families. So we look at our growing list of what do we do with self. We can't deny our self-existence. We can't decorate ourselves. We don't want to deify ourselves or deceive ourselves or divide ourselves. The biblical answer is death to self. Well, that sounds pretty radical. Well, how do we die to self? We lose yourself that you may find yourself. We saw that in Mark 8:34 and 35 and Luke 9:23. Galatians 5:24 says, "Moreover, those who belong to the Messiah Yeshua have put their old nature to death on the stake, along with its passions and desires." We're talking about crucifying self here. Galatians 2:20, "When the Messiah was executed on the stake as a criminal, I was too, so that my proud ego no longer lives. But the Messiah lives in me, and the life I now live in my body, I live by the same trusting faithfulness that the Son of God had, who loved me and gave himself up for me." We mortify self, Colossians 3:5. "Therefore, put to death the earthly parts of your nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed," which is a form of idolatry. We put off, Ephesians 4:22 through 24. "Then, so far as your former way of life is concerned, you must strip off your old nature, because your old nature is thoroughly rotted by its deceptive desires. And you must let your spirits and minds keep being renewed and clothe yourselves with the new nature created to be godly, which expresses itself in the righteousness and holiness that flow from the truth." We are to put away. Ephesians 4:31 says, "Get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, violent assertiveness, and slander, along with all spitefulness." We are to lay aside. In James, Yaakov 1:21, "So rid yourselves of all vulgarity and obvious evil, and receive meekly the word implanted in you that can save your lives." In 1 Peter 2:1, it says, "Therefore rid yourselves of all malice, of all deceit, by hypocrisy and envy, and of all the ways there are of speaking against people." We are to walk in the Spirit. Galatians 5:16 says, "What I am saying is this, run your lives by the Spirit, then you will not do what your old nature wants." I close with a poem that I really like. It encapsulates so much of the problems of selfishness. It's called "The Cold Within" by James Patrick Kinney. Six humans trapped by happenstance in dark and bitter cold, each one possessed a stick of wood, or so the story's told. Their dying fire in need of logs, the first woman held hers back, for of the faces around the fire, she noticed one was black. The next man, looking across the way, saw one not of his church, and couldn't bring himself to give the fire his stick of birch. The third one sat in tattered clothes. He gave his coat a hitch. Why should his log be put to use to warm the idle rich? The rich man just sat back and thought of the wealth he had in store, and how to keep what he had earned from the lazy, shiftless poor. The black man's face bespoke revenge as the fire passed from sight, for all he saw in his stick of wood was a chance to spite the white. The last man of this forlorn group did naught except for gain. Giving only to those who gave was how he played the game. The logs held tight in death's still hands was proof of human sin. They didn't die from the cold without. They died from the cold within. Shabbat Shalom.